Questions about anything? So, you know, the plan start out is with these constellation quizzes, and I'll try and do what I think are the easy ones first and move on to the harder ones. The idea is to kind of do three a day. So what you're going to do is put on that little sheet of paper ABC for the three constellations and your name, and all you have to do is write the name, something that approximates the name of that constellation, on the piece of paper. And I don't know, the two easiest I think are pretty clear cut. I'm never sure what to choose as the third easiest. So this guy here is constellation A. So A, and then the name of a constellation. Constellation A. Constellation B. Common names are as good as official names. And I think I'm going to pick this guy as the third easiest. So that's constellation C. I'm not sure what the third easiest one is. It's got a bright star. It has another feature that is really particular to it. Okay, so usually go through these twice just to make sure people got them. I imagine that there aren't a lot of questions about constellation A and constellation B. And we'll bring back the one that is, I think, of the three is certainly the hardest one. And that is the ever popular constellation C. So your name, three constellation names, the letters A, B, C, send them that away. On that, I hope everyone did it on that little sheet of paper. So they will get harder. Yes.
Are you ever going to orient them differently?
I will try and orient them more or less consistently, but I won't intentionally disorient them. How's that for a statement? And I think all of these were oriented pretty much the same way they were. For the circumpolar constellations, it really is pretty much fair game. Okay, constellation C is, I think, the harder one. What is it?
Taurus.
Taurus, right? In constellation A, Orion. In constellation B, Big Dipper is fine. Okay, so we'll be doing this once a day for kind of 4 days, and then it'll be a 10-point question on the exam two, which is, I think exam two is after break. I'm not entirely sure about that. Of course, the date is online in the syllabus. You can almost be sure that none of the constellations that you had today will be the ones that are on the exam, unless I pick Taurus. I will pick at least reasonably hard ones for the exams, ones that you probably didn't know before you were in this class. So that was the Constellation to Know quiz, lots of them in the future. You should have taken Spectra Quiz 1 last night.
I did not.
don't know if it was just me. I did not understand the spectrum at all.
Okay.
I just didn't understand like the first couple of questions with the. I don't remember specifically. It was like the color like spectra on top, and then it had like a graph, and it was like which ones. Like, where's blue on the map? I just did not find that.
Yeah. So hold off on that for a second. We'll put it up in a second. Labs are next week, so you should have had some handouts on the lab. So part of it is to fill out that table. You go to that website, and you can find most of the information if you look at the text. Some of the information, like the physical size of it, you may have to calculate using the formula that's provided. Home lab one, it's due before Easter break. Home lab two was already due, and you should have a purple dot next to your name if you've turned it in. Like Pat turned it in recently, you don't have a purple dot, but you will soon when I get a pen. So if I'm missing a purple dot and you did turn it in, tell me. I think they're mostly complete. Okay, so spectra quiz one. What's going on with it? So the basic idea of a spectra, of course, is it's a graph of the amount of light versus wavelength or frequency. Most commonly for us, it's going to be wavelength. So here's kind of a display of the rainbow, and we have the numbers, the wavelengths that correspond to them above the list. And here's a more typical plot where we have this kind of bell-shaped curve. This one has a peak wavelength of about 1 micrometer. And what we're supposed to do is to figure out what the amount of blue light is. So blue, I say here, is blue corresponds to a wavelength of 0.45 micrometers. So what I need to do here is to go to 0.45, so there's 0.4, there's 0.45, and then I read up and over, and I don't know, 5, 6 seems like the right answer, and 6 is a possibility, so I would click 6. Does that kind of answer your question? So I won't finish it. You can still do it, you know, this afternoon, something like that. Other questions about this quiz?
I had a question about like the whole thing in general. Does the intensity mean that it produces more light, or is it just?
So the intensity we observe is a combination of two things, right? How close we are to it and how physically bright it is. So the kind of complicated words for this is the apparent magnitude. That's what we've been dealing with out at the observatory, where we have bright stars that are magnitude 1 and dim stars that are magnitude 5. And we have what's called the absolute magnitude, or the luminosity, and that's a measurement of the actual brightness of that star. So if we had all the stars lined up at a particular distance, then the small numbers for absolute magnitude would correspond to the bright stars. So luminosity is the wattage of the star, the actual amount of light it's producing. How intense it seems to be depends on its distance. And incidentally, so a very common question is to ask, are the bright stars bright because they're absolutely bright or because they're near? And the answer is kind of yes. So if you were to look at the 100 brightest stars, and get a list of them, and if you were to look at the 100 closest stars, there wouldn't be a lot of overlap. So, but on the other hand, some bright stars in our sky are actually pretty close, like Sirius and Alpha Centauri. We don't see Alpha Centauri, but it's a pretty bright star in the southern hemisphere. So it's a mix. Most of the bright stars whose names you know, like Betelgeuse and Rigel, those are pretty far away. They're not neighboring stars. More questions? Okay, so two times ago we were kind of dealing generically with waves in the form of sound, and last time we got more specific when we started to talk about light per se. And we said kind of the first question you want to ask about a wave is what is it that's waving? In the case of sound, it has to do with the material. Compressed air, expanded air. And so in the absence of air, you can't have sound. But that's not what light is. Light isn't made out of anything, and so it can travel through nothing. It can travel through a vacuum just fine. And what it's made out of are these transverse electromagnetic waves. And I had this kind of cheesy set of transparencies that had little arrows on them. And the upshot of that is the electromagnetic stuff is pointing up or down or to the right for the wave that's moving this way. And just as with sound, what we perceive is not all that is. And in fact, for light, it's hugely more than what we in fact perceive. So if you can think about kind of like the keys on a piano, and of course you can hear way beyond the keys of a piano, so 88 keys and maybe 1,000 different pitches that you can easily distinguish with your ear. The equivalent thing for light is just an octave. So we can experience a very small fraction of what is. And we have different names for these types of light, but they're all perfectly good light. So radio light, what you pick up with your radio, with AM bands. If something is like at 1500 on a radio band, that means it's at 1.5 million cycles per second. FM radio, if you're listening to something that's 101, that's 101 million cycles per second. So radio waves have fairly big wavelengths. In the case of FM, we're talking about something like 3 meters. In the case of AM, we're talking about things like 100 meters. But it's perfectly good light. We just don't perceive it. Microwave light has a wavelength that's about 1 centimeter. What's special about microwaves is that they're tuned so that water will particularly absorb that color of light. So the light is pretty nicely transferred into heating of the turkey or whatever. Infrared light, talking about, say, 10 microns wavelength, frequencies of a million hertz. Visible light, we're talking about frequencies that are so big that there aren't kind of common names for it. Maybe tera? I forget. 10 to the 14th or so cycles per second. I like wavelength better because the numbers seem more natural. So the wavelengths of light are about half of a millionth of a meter. Ultraviolet light, shorter frequencies, less. If we're talking about X-ray light, then we're talking about wavelengths that are the size of an atom. And finally, gamma ray light for the highest frequency light, the shortest wavelength light. And we talked about how, generally speaking, these guys are the dangerous types, and these types are the more or less harmless types of light, and that's something that we need to explain at some point. So we experience different frequencies of sound as pitch. In the case of light, we experience different frequencies as color, but it's a pretty crude correspondence. So that things like these fluorescent light bulbs and the incandescent light bulbs may seem to be the same to our eye, but we'll see today that they're really totally different. So really, instead of being able to hear 1,000 different pitches, we can basically just see 3 different wavelengths, the kind of RGB, red, green, blue intensity of the light. And so colors, just as music can be a chord, a combination of lots of frequencies at the same time, colors like purple are a combination of, say, red and blue in that particular circumstance. The colors of the rainbow are therefore are the pure tones. They're the ones that are a subset of everything that we can see. Light is always produced by accelerated charge. For a radio antenna, it's the electrons going up and down the wire. For a microwave, it's this guy. This is a magnetron, and there's, as the name suggests, there's a magnet. So the light comes out of this little tube, and it would go into the big container and heat your turkey. Synchrotron radiation is the name for that. That's where the electrons are going in circles because of a magnetic field. And going in a circle is accelerating, and so they produce light. Pretty high frequency light because electrons are going at a really high speed inside this microwave. X-ray radiation, the German word for it is Brunstrahlung, means breaking radiation, because what's happening is the electrons are being moving at high speeds and are slamming into this copper finger that sits out. The only thing that's special about that copper is it gets, since you're slamming electrons into it all the time, it gets to a pretty high temperature, so it needs to be cooled off a bit. But just by deaccelerating those electrons, you make the high-frequency light that is X-rays. So most of what the online process was about was spectra. And we think about spectra, that word is referring to this kind of rainbow pattern, but we really want to convert that into a plot where we kind of run a light meter down this graph and look at the amount of all of these various colors of light and plot them on a corresponding curve. So we talked about doing that for sound. Obviously for light, it's going to play a much bigger role. So noise is a combination of all of the frequencies at the same time being randomly, not orchestrated, produced. And the same thing happens in the Edison-type light bulbs, where we have a hot object. So through a random process, all the frequencies of light are pretty much constantly being produced in various ratios that are respective of the corresponding spectra, kind of a bell-shaped curve. And we said that there is a relationship between the temperature of the object and the corresponding spectra. Things have to be plugged in to work. So here we have a hot object, 9,000 degrees Kelvin, 6,000 is about the temperature of the sun. And the most striking difference is we got a lot more light. More light at every wavelength for this hot object compared to this cool object. There's a subtler effect, and that is there's a shift towards shorter wavelengths. So here the peak wavelength is, roughly speaking, half of a millionth of a meter, whereas here at 9,000 degrees, the peak wavelength is closer to 0.3 millionths of a meter. So these kind of important factoids, if you increase the temperature, the amount of light increases like temperature to the fourth. So if you double the temperature, you're going to have 16 times as much light. And there's a subtler shift in the distribution of light to shorter wavelength, so that the peak wavelength is proportional to 1 over the temperature. Questions? Well, we want to see this with our own eyes. And in order to do that, I think I started to say last time, we need to be able to break light up into its component colors. And the way I think you're most used to thinking about doing that is with a prism. But prisms are really pretty bad dispersers of light in comparison to other sorts of things like diffraction gratings. So let's take a look, maybe. So here I have a couple of lasers, red laser and a green laser. And if I can find my prism, oops. So you can see that they have about the same altitude now. When I put them in a prism, the red is slightly lower in altitude than the green. So I don't know, maybe a half an inch separation between those two colors? Not much. One thing that is important about prisms, though, is that 100% of the light is separated out, right? So we have separate dots for red and green, and then we have separate dots for red and green, and 100% of the light is separated out, but not by very much. So the alternative device is a diffraction grating, and we said that this is just like a CD, and somehow just a bunch of parallel lines are enough to shift out the light. So now notice that most of the light is still going straight, but if you look there at the top, you can see that there's a green dot, and just below there's a dim red dot. So notice here we get a big separation, maybe a foot separation between the green and the red, but that most of the light is not being sorted out. So it's less efficient in the sense that most light isn't separated, but it's better in the sense that there is more separation between the various colors of light. In this case, notice that the long wavelength is shifted more than the short wavelength, Whereas with the prism, it was the other way around, right? See if I can convince myself that there's any separation. Yeah, so the red light is shifted not quite as much as the green light, whereas it was the reverse for the diffraction grating. Okay, so two ways of separating light. The cheaper, better separation is with the diffraction grating, cheap to make because it's just a lot of parallel lines on plastic. And more effective, although less efficient in terms of the amount of light that's produced. So what we have are some devices which have a piece of that plastic in the eyepiece. So you can send those around. Yeah, I guess we're going left and right, huh? Take one. One. Here you go. I want one too. So if you look at this eyepiece, you can kind of see that it's like a CD. It has kind of that colored pattern in it. And here is where the light is going to come in. So you want to aim this piece of it at a bright piece of light, and then you don't want to look at that dot. You want to look to the side, because you remember that's what the diffraction grating does. It puts the light to the side. And there's a nice scale in order to read the corresponding numbers. So let's test this out on a nice incandescent light source. So this was here a minute ago. So what you should see is a scale that looks just like this. And inside this scale, you should see all the colors of the rainbow, with the red near the 700 and the blue near the 400. So if you're not seeing that, tell me. Everyone seeing it? So what's the number that corresponds to yellow? 5, 8, 8. So there are numbers on top and there are numbers below. So currently we're using the 100 numbers. So what's yellow? Louder?
575.
Yeah, short of 600, right? Close to, but short of 600. Are people seeing that? Okay, so let's take a look at the fluorescent lights. So I see kind of totally different stuff. So this is not exactly what you'll see, but when you were looking at the incandescent lights, you saw all the colors of the rainbow. When you're looking at the fluorescent lights, you see there is a big band that is continuous, but there are lots of individual colors present. Right? So in particular, I see a kind of violet color that's maybe at 440, and green colors that are about 550, and a red color that's maybe at 610. Are people seeing that? So I don't watch television, so I don't know if the television ads are still on. But for a while, GE was touting these lights, which are called reveal lights. And they claim that they make your living room look particularly nice. What do they look like? Well, why? why am I having trouble today? Yeah. I wonder if I turn that a little bit. Is that good for you guys, or for me it's not so good? So what's that one look like? Questions. So what are you paying an extra dollar for GE's reveal as opposed to the cheaper lights? Yeah, so remember that black is an absence, right? So it's not that this is producing black light, it's that it's not producing the yellow light. So something is eating the yellow light. The inside of these lights is the same as a normal incandescent light, but if you look at the, if I turn it off, if I look at the light under room temperature, you can see there's some sort of coating that's on the inside of that light bulb. So that coating is absorbing the yellow light so that it doesn't get out. Okay. So, I think this is our second to the last of these cheesy get together in groups of three, and I bet it's the last time you get to play with crayons as a college student. So what I want you to do is to draw what you see. We'll do it all again. That way I can believe that you're seeing what you're supposed to see. You guys are a group of three. You guys gonna be a group of three? Tasha, these guys, group of three. Oops, only needed one of those and you needed the crayons. I guess I know that there are some people who are colorblind, so picking the right color will require your partners.
So this is the floor stuff.
It's like 400. It's like a perp flash of blue.
It's like by 400.
Okay.
Is this fine? Or do we have to crash and switch things?
Well,
oh, yeah, I screwed that up.
Yeah, you can just cross them out. I think you could. Most people are doing a little bit better than that. Okay, so maybe one more minute on fluorescent.
So what I can see when I look through there, I have to kind of tilt it, and then I see a line underneath the numbers, not split.
Yeah, so let's see if we can turn this to adjust it a little bit. Oh, no, it works fine now. So right now I have the bands that are right inside the box.
Oh, you adjusted it though, right?
Well, I didn't think I did, but maybe I did. That's a lot of yellow.
Too much yellow.
I don't know. You see what you see. I don't see that much yellow, though. So another minute on normal incandescent. Reveal. People getting done. So I like the name Black Bars, but do remember really what's happening is that no light is being emitted where it's black, right? So it's not that the thing is putting black there, it's that it's taking out the yellow that would be there. You can use the black crayon to make it look like that, that's fine, but I'm just saying it's not really making black light.
Thank you.
So you continue doing it. Let's take a look at what's involved in the next online quiz. So using the web, I found people had taken pictures with digital cameras through these same spectroscopes. And it's clear that this is not the fluorescent lights that we have in this classroom, but you should have seen something pretty similar to that. That is to say, a bunch of colored lines with a lot of black in between them. And what we want to do is interpret that as one of these spectras. So here's another low pressure sodium street light. And again, we want to interpret that those set of colors in terms of these sorts of spectra. It may be helpful to remember that this is 600 billionths of a meter, and that's the same thing as 0.6 millionths of a meter, right? So here's the graph of what reveal looks like, and you're supposed to figure out which one of these matches. If we took this out and looked at the sun, this is kind of what you would see in an idealized world, which should look a lot like that. It's from Wikipedia. And here's where somebody actually tried to do that, to use a digital camera to take a picture. And what we see is something that's kind of like the reveal bulb, except that it's much more subtle. There are a series of very subtle wavelengths which look black. That is to say, where not much light is being produced. Okay, so people set for that one. So send your answers this way. So it's always seems to be about vocabulary. So it's going to be helpful to have names for these type of names for these type of spectra. And the spectra that has all the colors of a rainbow in it this one here, and that's the one that produces kind of this continuous line. That's called a continuous spectra. This one here, in which mostly no light is emitted at all of this big range of wavelengths, but there's light at this color and that color and that color, that's called an emission line spectra. So obviously light is being emitted in this case too, but this is what we call an emission spectra. Another name for this is bright line spectra, which is, I think, a more obvious name. So the reveal bulb, the one that looks like the solar spectrum, that's what we would call something like this. This is what we would call an absorption line spectra. And if we were to try and make the corresponding graph, there's lots of light at all of these various colors, but then we hit this particular wavelength, 486 nanometers, and there's a lot less light at that particular color. So just as there's a coating in those light bulbs that's absorbing some particular color of light, there's something in the atmosphere of the star that is eating this color of light. And we go back to having more or less the same color of light, little dip there, little dip there, etc. So I think you won't be able to use your spectroscopes on these guys, but you can try, and that's because they're pretty dim. What we have here are sources of light that are similar to the fluorescent light bulbs, except there's no attempt is being made to try and duplicate white light. So I don't know if you can see that or not. Anyone have any luck seeing it with a spectroscope? It's usually pretty hard.
Kind of see it.
Okay. Well, there should be a line in the red, and then a kind of a tealish line. Mostly stuff in between. So what this one is it has hydrogen gas in the tube. And it turns out that hydrogen gas is the most common element in the universe. So if you look at the color pictures from Hubble and you see red, that's almost certainly the light that's being emitted from hydrogen. And I've got a bunch of these tubes that have different gas in them. I think this is another hydrogen. So I won't be able to read them when I'm putting these things in, however. And my main point is just that different elements have... Well, I didn't even think about seeing if this worked before I brought it, because I was sure it would work. Okay. Be prepared. Well, I could switch over to the other one. We'll use this one. This is the old one, which I knew works. It's more dangerous because it's got all of these free leads on it that have danger 5,000 volts listed on them.
That's always fun.
But it would only kill me, so. I don't know what would happen to your grades if I got killed.
Instantaneous A?
We could try it and see.
You should make a note that says all my students get an A.
You could forge that after I'm done. I give you, if I'm dead, what do I care? With luck, I could tell the big guy what you did, and then you'd be in trouble. Okay, so supposedly, here's the on switch. Nope. I kind of didn't think there was an on switch, and it's not on. Okay, so maybe that's why. Okay, where? Oh, the plugs are going to the same place, but they're not both plugged in. This time for sure, says Bullwinkle. Yeah, pretty wimpy. But you can see that it's a different, well, maybe you can't even see that it's a different color.
It looks pink.
Yeah, it looks more pink. I think it's helium. I've got another set of these that I can go through, but since I'm over here, let's see what else I've got. One of these should be very familiar to you. I did plug in the right one. No, I didn't plug in the right one. Okay, so let's not make that mistake again. Take this cord over there. This time for sure, huh? Looks exactly the same, doesn't it? I'm sure it's not. I did pick the tube so that they would be different. I'm about to give up on this and switch over to a different device. The other device is another one of these very safety-related ones, but it doesn't make... It hasn't worked there. Okay, so finally we get one that looks reasonable. So I think that's argon. In any case, it's different from the rest. I haven't gotten the one that I'm hoping to get. Maybe I've saved the best for last. So there's nothing particularly special about these tubes. All they have is gas in a tube with some plugs on it, and all the specialness comes from the 5,000 volts. I didn't see the one I particularly wanted. So this is the other setup we've got. And it has smaller, well, I guess if I unplug that I can see it. If I do it fast, I'll be able to see, huh? These light bulbs are smaller, so they're not. Ooh. And I think I should just be able to rotate these through. This is why we gave up on this. A lot of them don't work anymore. Well, let's. I should have brought a flashlight so I could see what so I could read the label. That one's not. There it is. What I've been looking for is neon, which has a very distinctive. I bet that's neon that's not working. Well, I'm going to kind of insist that we see neon. So that one was helium. This one is hydrogen. This one is nitrogen. That one's oxygen. Don't tell me I didn't bring neon it. There's mercury. Well, the reason you didn't see neon is I didn't bring it. Okay, well. So the upshot of that is supposed to be that every sort of element has a distinctive pattern of colored lines that it produces. And we can tell what the element is by the lines that are produced. So here's hydrogen. I'm not sure if you got a chance to see it, but you remember I said that there was a red line, and there's kind of a tealish line. But the upshot is every element has a distinct set of colors that it absorbs. And so we can tell what the element is according to what colors are absorbed. So recently, a water planet was detected around a distant star. The only reason they can tell that there's water on that planet is not that they can see the surface, they can't, not in the glare of the star, but they can see the absorption in the atmosphere of the star that's due to water. Okay. So we got some kind of cheesy demos again that illustrate how these spectra are produced. Okay, so here we see the light from a star, and it has photons, bits of light, that are all different colors. And here we see the spectrum that we get, namely all of the colors. And it doesn't look like some of those colors are as prominent as they should be, like on this screen. Looks like the green isn't as strong as it was. And if I put in an absorbing material, then that material will absorb and scatter particular colors. And so now in the telescope, we're going to have an absence of those particular colors. So those particular colors have been absorbed by the cloud. So we, is that going to do it? So we have an absorption spectra. And I wanted to, if you take a look at Wiki, you can learn a little bit about how color vision, in fact, works with people. It is a fairly complicated story. There's a fair amount of processing that goes on in order to convert these frequencies that we observe into the other sorts of relationships. So here we have the spectrum of the sun, most of the colors of the rainbow. If it's cooler, then we're just going to see the peak is someplace here in the infrared for this toaster oven filament, so it's going to glow with kind of a red. Neon is going to have all of these individual colors. Here's a hot star that's going to have more blue light than the sun is going to have. And when something looks green, what that means is that the other colors have been absorbed. So this is, particularly for plants, it's often a source of confusion with people. So people will sometimes think that if they want their plants to grow well, they're going to put them under a green light. But that's feeding the plant shit, right? It's the part of the light that it's not using. Right? You want to feed your plant blue light and red light, not green light. So here's the story we're going to start, and I don't think we're going to be able to finish it today, that we need to understand, and that is, how is it that we get this orchestration from natural phenomena, right? So we expect that natural phenomena are going to be like noise. They're going to produce all of the frequencies of light. But instead, we see something like instruments that are only absorbing particular frequencies of light, tuned instruments. And apparently, every atom is a little bit of a different tuned instrument. It only eats particular frequencies of light. And we kind of need to understand how that works. And we can play with this cheesy demo since it's dark now. But we'll want to come back and talk about this at much greater detail. So here we have what's called the ground state of the electron. So this is when the electron is in its closest possible approach to the nuclei. But there are other possible orbits that the electron could be in. And what an excited atom is, it's an atom in which the orbit is larger than it is normally. And it turns out that in kind of typically a billionth of a second, if an electron is in one of these high energy, high orbits, it's going to cascade down. And you can see from this picture that every time it goes down, a particular color of light is emitted. So there's some relationship between the size of the jumps that occur and the corresponding colors of light that are going to come out. And I guess I have one other kind of cheesy picture. I mentioned last time that if we look at the light of a candle, the light from this part of the candle is incandescent. So the only reason that piece of the candle is shining is because there are little pieces of soot, little bits of carbon, that are heated to extremely high temperatures and they're incandescent. But this blue part, that has to do with this sort of chemical excitation that we were talking about a moment ago with the kind of cheesy demonstration. So that's kind of the topic that's coming up, atomic structure. How is it that that atoms become tuned instruments that allow this all to work? But before I get there, I want to get to another cheesy demonstration, one after another. So this is an advertisement for polarized sunglasses. And kind of the bottom line is from 1978, as you can see, so before you were born. The guy can't ogle the girl with his normal sunglasses, but with Cool Ray Polaroid sunglasses, he can ogle all he wants. So what's going on with these polarized sunglasses? And why are they able to quote unquote kill the glare from the light? So this is a characteristic of light we haven't talked about called polarization. So you remember we said that light was a transverse wave, that if the light is going this way, the electromagnetic stuff is going to be pointed perpendicular to the direction that it's traveling in. It might be oriented that way, that way, that way. There are all sorts of different possibilities. And in a natural random occurrence, all of those would be simultaneously present. There would be no particular order to the direction of the electromagnetic stuff, aside from being perpendicular to the way the light is in fact traveling. So what polarized light is, it's light that has been organized so that all of the electric fields are pointing in the same direction all of the time. So if we take a random set of light and we only let through light that is of one particular orientation, the light's going to be dimmer, right? Because we've absorbed all of those other possibilities. So this is material that you might use then to dim sunlight. You might use it as sunglasses material, simply because it dims the light. But it has another property that is particularly special. So polarization has to do with the electric fields being organized and not random. And the magnetic, for that matter. So it's always perpendicular to the direction that it's going. But there are lots of directions that are perpendicular to the direction it's going. And in polarized light, it's organized so that they're all going in the same particular direction. So what's special about polarization? Well, so in the cheesy demo, we got the guy ogling the girl. And what's happening is we've got reflected sunlight that's interfering with this process. And the upshot is that automatically reflected light is polarized. So when light bounces off of a surface like this, it turns out that the light that is going this way, that is to say parallel to the surface, is going to be preferentially bounced, whereas the light that is going the other way is not going to be bounced. It's going to be refracted into the material. So if we have our sunglasses oriented so that this particular polarization of the bounce is blocked, and all of the natural light that's coming from the babe is not going to be blocked. Well, some fraction of it will be blocked, but the one that's in the right direction won't be blocked. So we will disrupt this this bounce light and be able to see all of the natural light. Okay, so aside from advertising, what does this have to do with astronomy? So one way we can detect stars is through the light that they bounce as opposed to the light that they produce. Naturally, the light of the sun is going to be unpolarized, but if we have reflected light from a star, like we often do in a nebula, then we're going to have polarized light. So here we have some of this Polaroid material, and if I orient these things correctly, and it's not very dramatic with the lights on, I guess, we get a dimming of the corresponding light. And so we can have these both polarizers agreeing to let the same direction through, or if one is letting light through that's going this way and the other one's only letting light going through that's that way, we're going to have no particular light that's passing. Okay, so polarized light is a sign of, you can make special materials for which Polaroid patented, or more naturally, you can have reflection producing polarized light. Okay, so here we have cross-polarized, where this one is only letting light through like that, and this one is only letting light through that's perpendicular to it, so nothing ends up getting through. So, one kind of surprising detail, which I'm not going to explain. So this is also polarizing material. So let's put it through so that not letting 100% of the light through, but it's letting some of the light through. And now let's block all of the light. I don't know. That, if you think about it, that should be crazy. But it is how it works. Okay, so if the guy is ogling the girl with his head at a 90 degree angle, then his sunglasses will fail. Well, maybe we'll do one other app. It's probably not going to get very far, but I'll have some sort of introduction, I guess. So every object that has a temperature produces light. So when we turn off the lights, we don't see that wall is producing any light, but it is producing light. It has a temperature, and so it's producing infrared light. We just don't see that infrared light with our eyes. So we know that the sun is a source of light, but you didn't know that the earth is a source of light, right? The earth has a temperature, and so it is shining. But it's shining with light that we don't normally see, infrared light. So this is actually the spectrum of Earth light. And you can see it's got this big absorption feature right in the middle of its black body spectra. And you can see the cause of that absorption feature is carbon dioxide. So we'll want to come back to that story in much greater detail in the future. Okay, so what we like to do is to understand how it is that atoms act like little musical instruments, in that they only produce or absorb particular frequencies of light. And I'm sure sometime in grade school you had the following sort of picture of an atom, right? So here's the nucleus, and here are the orbiting electrons. So just as in the case of the solar system, the nucleus is the heavy thing, so it stays basically at rest, and the electrons are the light thing, so they end up doing most of the motion. Of course, there are no unmoved movers, so the nucleus is also going to be moved around a little bit by these orbiting electrons. But if you think about it, this picture cannot be the case. It's got to be wrong. Because what we know is that light is produced if we have an accelerated electrical charge. And we know that something that's going around in a circle is accelerating. So this orbiting electron should be constantly emitting light, which is energy, and so it should be spiraling in to the nucleus. And we can calculate how long it should take for one of these orbiting electrons to hit the nucleus, and the answer is about a billionth of a second. It should happen really fast. So the fact that atoms are stable is a strong indication that this picture has something that's very much mistaken involved with it. Just for, 3 minutes of history or so, it may be worth commenting that the idea of an atom goes all the way back to the Greeks, right? So the fundamental question was whether material is continuous, that is to say you could divide it up into smaller and smaller pieces and it would still be a piece of that thing, right? So a very small piece of an elephant would still be elephant. Or whether we reached a point where we couldn't divide things up anymore. And the fundamentally indivisible pieces the Greeks called atoms. And the first thing that's maybe worth commenting about is that certainly not what we call an atom today, right? Because this atom that I've drawn, even though it's wrong, there must be something right about it since they taught you it in grade school, it has pieces. It can be taken apart. Where to a Greek, an atom would be something that would be indestructible. It couldn't be broken apart. So already we've kind of missed the boat on the original Greek idea of atoms. The idea of atoms comes about as much as anything else from chemistry, where people found that the facts that chemical reactions occur in definite fractions was a sign that there was fundamentally A combining with B or A combining with 2B at the very small scale, right? So for example, H2O. So the existence of these combining ratios for a while convinced chemists that there were these fine structures that the Greeks had hypothesized based on no data existed. Incidentally, not Aristotle, but other Greeks. But circa 1900, this idea was out of favor. For some of the reasons we've discussed, it doesn't seem to pan out if we believe that we understand how things work. And Rutherford is the physicist circa 1900, I think 1903, is the guy who came up with this picture based on some actual data. And what he found is that there seemed to be a heavy lump that had most of the mass of the atom, but not most of the size of an atom. And so the picture where there was something positive at the center, which was attracting the electrons, was his point of view, this kind of junior version of the solar system. But this junior version of the solar system is in stark contrast with physics as it was understood at the time. Maxwell had understood how charged electrons produce light circa 1860, and Newton, of course, had figured out how orbiting things were in fact accelerating. So Rutherford's picture, even Rutherford knew, had to be in some sense wrong, and it needed to be corrected in a big way. So we have to basically throw out Newton in order to explain how atoms work. And I think we'll pick that up then next time.